say it every week, we all love to go out to eat. But do we ever think about what's happening behind the kitchen doors? That's what this show is all about, to show you what, and open the doors and take a look at the world of cooking in all its forms these days, not just in kitchens, but in homes and everywhere else, with the man who does it all day long. He never does anything but cook. Chef Pascal, welcome.
I do stop to eat.
Do you? I wasn't sure.
Because, you know, while cooking, if you don't eat, that's sometimes you don't know if you cook for yourself or you're just going to cook for others.
I never asked you that. Do you nibble as you cook along?
Or you have to taste as you go.
Oh, you have to taste. Oh, yeah. Everywhere. At home, in the kitchen, when I do an event, I always test my food. Just to make sure it's done right. Okay. If not, I talk to the chef, say, hey, chef, fix this.
But then do you actually sit down and enjoy it, or are you always serving and preparing? And
I don't know if people are more understanding about because of my aging time. So at the end of the event, I say, chef, why don't you sit with us?
Yeah.
And we share the dinner together.
Exactly.
And it's wonderful.
Yeah,
so it's very special. Speaking about sharing, our guest, my guest today, is a very good friend, and also is a food passionate. We call them foodie.
Foodies.
I don't like the foodie name, but it's not about just dining out. It's about cooking in. And also traveling and always find the right place to eat and discovering everywhere in the world, local food, top restaurant, meeting top chef. And so really develop a relationship when I had a restaurant in Corona del Mar and to a friend on social media, and we see exchange some food preparation and things like that. And so this is Chet Harrison. Hi, Chet.
Hello.
And I'm told that he's, in real life, a technologist. He writes software and does other stuff. So what do you do for a day job here?
I actually work at Trico Realty. It's a company that owns about 2.5 million square feet of industrial space. And I help on the tech side with the company.
There you go. And you wrote an app we were talking about here called what? Nimble Chef.
Yes.
Trying to combine your passion for food and your knowledge of technology.
Proud to say that was a few years ago when Chet came to me as to get my opinion on it. And then we kind of, and can you explain what
What was Nimble Chef? Is it still around? Yeah. You're not sure if it's still up there or not?
Yeah, I think it's retired, but I wanted to solve what I call the Thanksgiving problem. A well-written recipe will give you the proper sequence in which you should execute all the instructions. But when you add multiple recipes to a menu, it becomes that much more complicated.
And for a lot of people.
Yes.
And at a certain time. It's got to go down at 4 o'clock or whatever, 5 o'clock.
Yeah, and it's the name of the game in the kitchen is know what you can prep and prep as much as you can so that when guests show up, you can produce something all the minutes.
And to have it come out all at the same time. That was what I always struggle with. Is, oh, my God, we're waiting for this
turkey
or something.
But you're talking about restaurant preparation and execution. But with Chet, we were talking about home cooking.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's the same problem. It's worse for home cookers. Yeah.
It is the same thing. You need to be organized. Actually, I will do a topic on that. You need to have timelines. You need to have a list of shopping lists with day when you can buy your product and then the prep list. If you want to start 2-3 days ahead, so you have to schedule all the production.
Exactly.
And then either your guests in a restaurant can show up because the food will be ready, but you can do the same thing at home.
Am I the only one? The real problem is you start laughing or talking or you suddenly go, oh my God, we didn't start this or we didn't pull this out. And all of a sudden, the line, there is no expediter in the home kitchen here. There's nobody saying, hey, come on, pull that out, check this, look, get this going here.
No, and then you miss your own party.
I miss my own party. The party misses me because we're waiting for the turkey to get finished here, and it's an hour late or something.
When a lot of people don't really think when they're putting together a multiple course meal about the fact that you've only got one oven in your house, four burners.
And that's right.
If two recipes are competing for your resources, then you've got a problem, and you might as well find out before you try to cook that thing.
Was your Nimble Chef just a timeline? It was like a giant timer that told you when to start things and when to pull them out? Or
yeah, you had several recipes in there, and you could make a menu, and then it would schedule, interleave the instructions between all of them so that everything turned out at the same time. And it would tell you if you're going to have a bottleneck or a problem before you started.
Yeah,
we always had a bottleneck, and it's usually because there's a bottle around somewhere here.
And then when your friend calls, say, "Oh, I'm going to be 15 minutes late. Oh, good.
Stay longer. Take longer.
Take your time.
So that's the miracle to me. What you do production cooking at a kitchen to watch it come out precisely, it does precisely on time.
But in a professional kitchen, you have no choice, is it? Very fixed timeline. You have reservation, 5:30, 6 o'clock, boom, you've got to be ready. So.
What do you say, though? This is just off the topic for a little bit. It happened to me a while ago. We're at a nice restaurant. It's busy. It's a Friday night or a Saturday night. And they start telling the two things I never want to hear. We ran out. Yeah. How did you run out on a Friday night? This isn't Monday morning or something. How do you run out of something? And two, we're running late.
Yeah,
and they come out and try and make excuses. And you're like, the whole thing is ruined.
Bad planning.
Yeah.
If your restaurant has been open for some time, you should know the average sales of every single dish.
Yeah. I would think so, especially when it's a special. That's usually run out of the special.
Oh, special is okay. They just say, oh, no, there's no special tonight. That's all right.
Nothing drives me crazier than they get you all excited and order and they come back and say, oh, sorry, we just ran out. Sorry. Oh, okay.
So, really, let's go back to relationship. So,
yes.
As customers, regular customer, we could see the passion, this same passion, either as an ongoing client, the food, and also passion to please the client that really knows about food. And so,
is that the case? Do you work harder if somebody shows an interest or knowledge of food?
Don't work harder, but we like to impress.
Oh, this guy knows. Okay, I got to show him something here. So what was it like going to eat at Chef Pascal's place?
Oh, it was always fun. I think the first meal I had was at Traditions.
Yeah.
And then he opened a creperie over at Sherman Gardens, which is conveniently a block from my house.
Okay.
And I used to take my kids there all the time on the weekends just to get them out of the house, run them around. And the creperie was always fun. I miss Rad Juan, by the way.
Yeah.
And then he opened kind of a more formal dining over there. It was a cafe, and that was always fun to pop over. And then when COVID struck, he started selling. He opened a little produce stand in the parking lot. In the back of the...
I can see him at a produce stand in a parking lot. Yeah. Hey, come on over.
Produce and also kind of commodity product because we had access, had inventory, flour, egg, and...
Oh, interesting. So, okay.
Gallons of olive oil.
Yeah, olive oil,
So it was great because my coping strategy during COVID was the French Laundry. In that cookbook, there's 100 recipes. And
really, that many he has in that French Laundry?
Yeah, there's 100 recipes, and I originally bought the book probably 20 years prior, but you really couldn't get your hands on a lot of the high-end products, like the white truffles and the foie gras. And,
can't go down to Ralph's and say, where's your foie gras section here?
Yeah, and the fine caviars. But when COVID hit, everyone had to go online, so all of the purveyors of those really expensive products sold direct, and part of my exploration was finding these great sources. So I managed to cook 53 of the 100.
Wow.
And I would always bring over a little sample for Pascal when I go to his stand to pick up some produce.
And did he make that that face he makes here sometimes takes his nose up a little bit? Exactly.
No. I think his first remark, I brought you over some kind of oyster dish, and he said, you got the job.
You got the job.
But you know why I said that? I could not have any staff at that time during COVID.
Yeah. So,
but Chet really is a perfectionist. No, he likes perfections. And when you read a recipe, you really follow the step by step, and then you add your own little touch. But you really respect what the chef wants to do.
Yeah.
So. You're one of now two or three people he's brought in who we'll call home chefs. And I didn't know that home chefs had gone to that kind of level. I should have, because I had a very dear friend of mine who passed away a number of years ago. He was one of those. He would not just cook, he would try and replicate what was either in the cookbook or what he'd experienced at the restaurant. He would to the point of buying extra equipment, to searching out the right source stuff, not just sticking to the basics here.
And that's the beauty of it, I think, that you can cook at home probably better food that you can find in any of the local restaurants.
So have you tricked out your kitchen with better stuff, or are you still just using the same stove that came with your house here?
Part of the blessing of my kitchen is it's small, so you can't really fill it with too much stuff. You figure out over the years if something's sitting on your countertop and you've touched it twice.
Yeah, I got a lot of those.
It goes into the garage, you know, but... Right. But
the
as
thing
far
we
as
made bread with or something, we did it 1 year, and I think we've been in the garage ever
exactly.
since.
Exactly, the bread machine,
was a trend.
And there's always the gadget section when you're in like Sur La Table or Williams-Sonoma. I haven't really bought a whole lot of equipment in a long time. I'm happy with what I've got. I would say notable additions would be a sous vide setup. Those I find handy.
I don't even know what that is.
We talked about that before.
I know. I forgot already.
It's what they call an immersion circulator. So you have a kind of a bathtub. You can use a pan. These systems used to be super expensive, but then these guys figured out they can make it on the cheap.
Yeah.
And you just stick a heating element with a fan in the water, so it circulates at a very specific temperature.
It's very scientific, because temperature, timing, everything is the key for every ingredient. And you have to calculate versus the weight of the ingredients.
For how long and at what temperature and all that kind of stuff.
But it's great, like, for example, if you want to cook a steak to a specific temperature, what I like to do is I'll sous vide a steak for an hour at maybe like 100 degrees, and then I'll get out a cast iron pan, get that scorching hot, get a nice crust on your steak, and then butter baste it with some crushed garlic and whatever herbs you want, thyme or
a lot of people do, or if they're using a barbecue, they pre-cook it to a certain point and then finish it off on the
in a way kind of safer, because the temperature, the inner temperature of the meat is,
my dad knew the inner temperature. He was sitting out in the dark with a flashlight and the barbecue, and he cut into it and said, that looks pretty good to me here.
And we have this fun family tradition every year. We go out to the Furnace Creek Inn in Death Valley, and
That's a unique place to go out to. I've been there once a million years ago.
I got married there.
Oh, you did? Yeah. At the Furnace Creek Inn?
Yeah.
Did they have the sign outside and went up to 130 today or something, or 120? Yeah.
I got married in May.
Talking about temperature.
Yeah, temperature, right. Crazy place. In the middle of nowhere is this nice place, yeah.
But anyways, we always assign a meal to my dear friend Erica Schulte, and then I take a meal one night. And it's always a challenge to cook because you don't really have a kitchen. So I'll bring out my sous setup and then a little butane burner. Like
in the room you're doing this? You're cooking?
No, you can do the sous inside. You can do that anywhere. There's no fumes. And then I just go outside. We've got like a little deck. And I can put down that butane burner and get the crust part. It's always a challenge to see what you can do when you don't have a full kitchen.
Yeah, exactly.
But you always, when you have passion to cook, you always find a way to cook any location, any equipment.
You've talked before about cooking on boats. Some friend of yours would take you on some big boat on the ocean.
Small galley, whatever. As long as you have something to heat up, you're fine, I told you my story when I was doing a wedding in Laguna Beach. Then we had a big power outage.
Yeah.
And 120 guests were waiting for their food. And so big panic. I asked the host, the groom said, do you have a barbecue? Say, yeah. Oh, okay. So we're good.
Okay, let's fire it up.
part of the challenge, it's fun. You have to think it through, but got to make it work.
So has food, I think the theme of today's show is technology meets food. Food wasn't necessarily even though it always had a technology too. You got to cook at a certain temperature and a certain time and all these types of things. But I pictured the chefs like Pascal more like painters, artists, not as whatever the other part of your brain that uses technology and math and all that. But with the amount of equipment and the other stuff, I find that I think technology is taking over a bigger role in cooking these days. Am I wrong? Are people still just
you want to answer that?
Cooking like my mother did or something, just out of instinct.
I will say that I can't speak to the professional side, but when I was working on the Nimble Chef project, I would go out to, what's the electronics, CES?
Yeah.
Out in Vegas.
A computer electronics show. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was interesting when you got to the cooking section of the all the displays, how much all the big companies are trying to get into this sort of automated help you in the home kitchen,
yeah,
with smart refrigerators and smart burners, and you can see how a system like
Combi oven,
all the new types of ovens and stuff they have. Yeah,
but you could see how a system like the one that I wrote in Nimble Chef could be the orchestrator of turning on this equipment or turning off that equipment,
and
checking your fridge to make sure you've got all the ingredients you need. It's a pretty fascinating space. I haven't seen anything blow my mind. But
who's your friend that sells all the equipment that was in here?
Oh, yes.
Fisher or something?
Fisher Group, yeah.
And so they have a test kitchen, warehouse, whatever you want to call it.
But they installed a
showroom.
Yeah.
And the cutting edge cool stuff they have now, particularly for professional kitchens that don't want to put a hood in or can't put a hood in because of their location. They're in the basement of an office building or something here. And unique kinds of, what do they call them, the convection ovens and all the other stuff here.
Yeah, but especially we're talking about the oven. Yeah, especially for baking or making bread, you need to have special humidity versus temperature. So you can program that now.
So he said there's tons of tech now, tons of stuff you can buy. Yeah. And they're starting to, if I remember the conversation, it was all for professional kitchens, but they're starting to realize that there's an equally big market for home kitchens, particularly upscale homes across along the beaches here where they're putting in 2-3 kitchens. There's the dirty kitchen where they do the work and the show kitchen that everybody sits around and pretends.
So, Chet, let's go back to food. What would be, if you have to name one or two, your favorite food to cook?
Yeah,
favorite food to cook.
First of all, what style? Do you cook French? Do you cook Italian? Do you cook fusion?
I'll cook everything. Okay. Actually, I make a pretty mean chicken pad Thai.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite go-tos. Because the thing I like about Asian cooking typically is that you prep, everything's ready, and then you get a pan that's really hot, and everything goes in there, and you can just bang it out.
The old idea of woks or something, you just throw it in.
Doesn't mean you have to be ready.
Yeah, you have to be ready.
Because it's fast, yeah.
But it's nice because it's one of those kinds of dishes where you can prep everything like hours, if not a day in advance.
Yeah.
You'd probably soften the noodles day of. But once that's all ready to go and your guests are coming in, you can serve a couple of cocktails, hit that pan, you're only in the kitchen for 10, 15 minutes at the most.
And you're eating.
You can watch this like on TV. You go to the Today Show, and they have chef coming in, and they have all this food prep, and then boom, boom. I'll say, we have only 3 minutes or 4 minutes. Yeah, boom, done, done.
And they're eating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's quick seared and all that stuff here.
Yeah, and then there's other types of dishes, like there are dishes that you want to start an hour in advance, and then you can walk away.
You like to braise. I've seen you braise some beef bourguignon, coq au vin.
And so I think when you're planning a menu and you're going to entertain, you want to think about the end, like how much busy work do I have at the end as opposed to how much can I prep and cook ahead of time.
The two trends that have changed in my lifetime, there have been a number of food trends that have changed. The whole idea of fusion, merging different cuisines. We used to go to a French restaurant or an Italian restaurant or a Chinese restaurant, never one that did all three and combined them. But the other thing that's changed is this idea of home cooking, which is we had a kitchen, but we never hung out in the kitchen. If there was a party, the food came out. Either my mom was back there doing it or my grandma, or you brought in people to help do it if it was a really big party.
Yeah, in the old setups for houses, we lived in a house when Amy was in Minneapolis.
That's where I was born originally, in Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah. That's where she met her medical school. And it was an old-style house where the kitchen was hidden away.
Yeah.
And then you would present your dishes to the guests.
What came out of you sat in the dining room or the living room, and then they called you into the dining room, and you waited for the food to arrive. Yeah.
But the problem is that everyone wants to talk to you, so everyone crowds into the kitchen, and now you got a problem because everyone's in the way, and you got hot pans, and you got to move around. Mm-hmm. And so when we moved out back out here, I made sure we had an open kitchen with a bar in front, so I could be in the kitchen. I got my space, but I can still interact with people as they
those kind of islands that they started putting in kitchens, all that. So that's common today, but I never saw it because the kitchen was where nobody went. The food was prepared there by somebody, either your parents or they brought in some help to help them out here, and then you just sat and waited for it to arrive, like at a restaurant.
Yeah,
I didn't go back into Chef Pascal's kitchen and say, hey, how are we doing today here, and sit and watch him make the food.
I would make you chop something.
Maybe chop something. Or
maybe peel some onions.
Yeah. And,
but what's beautiful, the last couple of decades, there's more and more people like Chet that love to cook. Love good food.
See them all the time, yeah.
And probably the Food Network.
I was going to say, did the food shows help? That didn't exist. There was, what's her name, the famous Julia Child.
Yeah.
She started the whole thing. Yeah.
She put the kitchen on fire.
But nobody watched shows all day like some of my buddies still do. All day watch the food show, watch Guy and a thousand other chefs or something here. Emerald. They've all become stars now. Yeah.
You have so much exposure to cooking now that, hey, why not me? And the new generation, even chat kids, are interested, and they come and check in the kitchen and see, hey, Dad, what are you cooking? What are you doing?
So,
do they have an interest in it? Do they show interest in it, or do they just wait for the result?
My number two kid, Oliver, he's our most adventurous eater.
And, many kids are these days here. Some of them just want to have fast food and forget everything else, and pizza.
Yeah, and he's 15, or actually, I guess he just turned 16.
He's listening to the show.
Yeah, I know.
How old is he?
But he's picked up a couple things, like fried egg, and if I'm not home, he'll go in the fridge and
pull something out. Yeah.
So it seems to the point of the food show bonanza. It seems we get Orange Coast magazine. It's like almost every 3 months, there's a food on the cover, the new restaurants.
They do a great job over there keeping food alive.
So clearly that content sells.
Yeah.
There's a big audience on the food. Mm. And there's more and more farmers market in Orange County.
Yeah.
And more food.
So does that hurt the dining scene then? I always wonder then, do people stay home more than they go out to eat then? Partly because they can and it's fun, and partly because it's more cost effective probably than going out.
I'm probably the best person to answer that, because I would say no, because I'm always more curious to go out and see what's new. And,
there you go.
And obviously, you go back to some of your favorites, but I'm the guy reading those magazines.
You're the guy.
Trying to figure out where's the next new thing.
That's me. I'm not a cook, but I'm always, people say, what's your favorite place? I said, the one I haven't been to yet.
Yeah.
As much as I like various restaurants, I'm always looking for something new and wow me, surprise me.
I mean, my wife and I...
Yeah, I'll go to a farmer's market, and then you can create your menu on the spot, pretty much.
Yes. Just buy what looks good.
Buy what looks good.
Yeah. But my wife and I are lucky enough to go to Paris next week.
Wow.
And we're gonna
we come with you? We'll be your camera crew here.
Come on down. Yeah, we're kick it off in Champagne. And,
there we go.
And take the TGV to Paris. And we're going to try some very exciting restaurants and some old classics.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Is Paris still... I've never been to Paris. Is Paris still the place? Is that Mecca still? Or for a certain amount of foodies?
You have so many places that you want to visit. Either you want to go to an old-time place... They've been there for a couple of centuries.
Yeah,
that's Rue d'Argent.
Yeah, and still good. But also a more casual, like some brasserie.
Recomier.
Yeah, and even like in the train station.
In the train station?
Gare de Lyon, there's a restaurant called Le Train Bleu, and it's a Michelin star restaurant in a train
station. In a train station.
Very old, like 1920. I think it was built for the Paris International Fair.
Okay.
And amazing food and decor.
And even casual creperies are great too.
Yeah.
They're awesome.
Yeah, good creperie with good butter and sugar and brown sugar.
So if I'm going to go, I got a bucket list. I'm going to go to one city in France. Do I got to go to Paris, the big city, or do we go to some little town somewhere?
Well, Lyon. Lyon is really still the capital of the French gastronomy, but at every level, from the three-star Michelin down to a little corner bistro called Le Bouchon.
And Leon is where, in the south?
Yeah. It's in the middle between, pretty much, between Paris and Marseille.
Okay, Marseille's on the coast, yeah.
So it's on Burgundy. The east side of France. But
is that the Burgundy region? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then a fantastic area for food and wine. Oh, talking about wine.
Yes.
Chet is a very big fan and very knowledgeable on fine wine.
Ah. Did he bring us some here today? Did he ready to uncork it here?
I should have.
The wine is breathing.
Yeah. It's breathing right now. Oh, it's destroying my life. It's always breathing somewhere else.
But he loves to go to wine countries like Napa Valley. And because Napa Valley now also is a food and wine, not just a wine area, it's a food and wine maker.
Isn't that where the French Laundry is in Napa
Valley? That's, when Keller showed up, that really changed. Obviously, Mondavi kicked off the whole wine side of things. Keller really cemented
Gergich, too. I think wasn't Gergich the first guy to win an international award?
Yeah, but there was no food at that time, really. But Sonoma, the village of Sonoma, also have great wine and food places. And then
I'll give a shout out to Chef Douglas up at Cyrus. He used to be in the Mars Hotel in Healdsburg, and then things didn't work out with the landlord, so he found a place up in Geyserville. Douglas Keene, just some of the most amazing meals I've ever had.
And what's the name of the restaurant?
It's called Cyrus, which is named after the guy that started, I think, Sonoma Valley. One of the early pioneers.
Okay,
like didn't Yonville know that. Okay. After
in Sonoma, they have a food and wine festival.
Yeah, they're parallel valleys there. They got Sonoma and Napa.
It's kind of mountain range in the middle.
Yeah. They have Pinot Noir festivals. Unbelievable. Yeah. So, Napa is...
I'm old enough to remember the 70s and when they first started doing fine wine, not just jug wine. And they won some... I think it wasn't Gergich the first guy that won
the Judgment of Paris.
That was it. And everybody was shocked that an American wine could compete. And nowadays...
At that time, he was working with Chateau Montelena.
Is that what he was? Yeah. I got to meet Mike Gergich a million years ago here. Funny little guy with a beret would always walk around.
Very nice guy. Very nice guy. And really, if you go to Napa, you even have some great farmer's market. And change a lot because now it's very touristy, unfortunately. But there's some great result now as well.
But they're suffering up there now because the wine industry is down across the board. Well, tastes are changing. I don't know that my daughter, who's in her 30s, has the same interest in going out and having wine with every meal that we once thought of.
I was just up there 2 weeks ago, and as you drive up Silverado Trail, you can see areas where they're pulling out vines. It's just...
Demand is down. And they're saying it might be, I don't know when this started, but we were talking about it. You had the sommelier, the guy in here who teaches chefs to put together wine lists and stuff, and wine has suddenly changed. My era, it was all about, especially if you're in California, a glass of wine for dinner or picnic or lunch or whatever. It's more like Italy or France. That passion for wine, something changed along the way.
Yeah.
The younger generation, on my daughter's age, or I don't know that they have.
The thing is, in California, let's talk about California wines. There's more option than just Napa and Sonoma. You have Santa Barbara.
Too many. Way too many.
Wine Paso. You have Paso Robles, Central Coast, and even here in Temecula is getting better and better.
Yeah, used to just be just for fun, but now they're getting more serious about it. And when you go out to Temecula, there were half a dozen wineries. Now there's 20 or 30 or something out there.
And but also one thing that started very well is that the fortunately, like chefs who are sharing knowledge and recipe, winemakers do, like with the French. So some French winemaker on California winemaker start to cooperate. And then it's where they create Opus.
So has the Opus, has it changed in France and Italy? And not having been there, I don't know if that's still, because that was part of their daily, almost little kids start drinking wine or whatever here. That sounds awful, but
French winemaking is still very classic. Actually, it's been used as a reference for the American winemaking.
Clearly.
And so if you do make Cabernet or Bordeaux blend, you need to know how this works
for, it's supposed
for
to
centuries
taste.
In France.
Right.
What can we make up on here? So today it changed.
And then there's wine around the world now. There's South African wine, there's Chilean wine, there's...
Even Chinese wine.
Is there Chinese wine?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's... I know some of those areas, New Zealand is well known for what they do. South Africa's come up, Chilean wine.
Well, every region of the world have their own type of wine that's specific with the terroir, with the location.
But for a long time, it was just kind of like some of the countries you go to, Gergic said when he was... Because he's from Croatia, I think, or something. He was from Croatia or something.
From Croatia, yeah.
And he said it was just cheap, sweet wines and stuff there. It wasn't...
Because it was not known, so they could not charge much money. But I went there to his winery. And then
he
I
always said Zinfandel. He always thought... Nobody knows where Zinfandel came from. He always said it was from Croatia.
It's a type of Zinfandel, but specific from the coast of Croatia, yeah.
That's where he always claimed it was from. I don't know if that's true or not, but he always believed that's from. Because they just found Zinfandel after... I don't know, it had been planted in the 1800s or something up in Northern California. And it's like, what is this stuff here?
But slacking food, he was very, we're going a little bit off the subject, but it's correlated actually. He innovated also, brought some older tradition. Like he tried to do, did, but micro-organic, biological grown.
He started
grapes.
That kind of stuff where they're really putting into the chemistry of it.
Yeah, last time I went to his winery, he took us to the vineyard and he sees that little trailer going through the row of a vine. I said, went inside. Oh, chicken coop.
A chicken
coop. So why?
Coop.
Oh, because when the chicken
poops in the coop.
It fertilized my soil. And then they push that thing all day, they move it around. And so, amazing. That's because they don't want to use any chemicals.
Go look up Milenko Gergic. There was just one of the early pioneers. I didn't meet many of them, but I don't know why I met him years ago at a wine tasting or something here.
Amazing man.
All right, so we got an amazing man here. You're doing traveling around the world, so it sounds like you build your vacations around food?
When I build my vacations, this is another computer nerd thing.
Okay.
I'm a bit of a control freak. I like to... I wrote some software to help me maximize my trips. Because
oh, my goodness. You're kidding. You just show up and say, hey, what do you got here?
Yeah, you don't want to wake up in Paris one morning and go, hey, you want to go to the Eiffel Tower? Or what do you want to do? You spend all the money. You've got, you're paying for the hotel room. You might as well have an idea of what you want to do. You don't have to make it a death march. You can bake in little
death march. We got to go there. We got to stop.
Yeah.
This looks fun. No, that's not on the schedule here.
That's why I like to pre-plan it almost like a menu, because you can look at the pacing. But I plan it down to the minute. I'm just like,
oh,
just
goodness.
Blocks of time, and I calculate how much time it's going to take to get on the train to Versailles or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So you don't have those moments of panic, especially when you got to move three kids and maybe a grandmother in tow. You don't want to be like, okay, we got to run to the terminal. You want to avoid all that stuff. So my plan is when I leave the house, I have a spiral-bound notebook with everything we're going to do, and I only book the things that you actually have to book.
Yeah.
So other things are suggestions. So if the kids are tired or they think it's boring, then, you know, we can split up or do other things. But at least
so many people just go and then they just get up. Yeah. And they just wing it. And then they say, let's not do anything today. Let's just sit in the hotel room, or I'm tired, or let's go down to the corner.
Well, you can do that, but it's like adventure, and sometimes the adventure turn out good.
Sometimes not so
good. I mean, that's two types of adventures, but when I do the research, I feel like when I show up, I'm able to see twice as much, have twice the vacation, and I don't have to think about it. When I leave the house, I don't want to think. I just want to, it's like an advent calendar. You just open it up and you're like,
oh. Advent calendar. Oh, look at that. I like, now you're getting back from my Catholic background here.
We're going to dinner tonight at the Pré Catelyn. So.
Good for you. Can you show me your next itinerary, and then we'll see.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastic. It's a great idea.
You take people to France, don't you, sometimes?
I do. But I preset some visit, some restaurant, on some wine tour, and things like that.
Do you go back in the kitchen?
Not to that extent, yeah.
Do you ever get to go back? So you show up and you say, hey, I'm somebody who's really interested. Can I go back in the kitchen? No, just sit out there.
I've done that, but I would never push away, especially a French chef, from his own kitchen. And so let the chef be doing what he knows what to do, and don't try to influence him on it. We're there for his cooking, not for mine.
And do you have to speak French to go to order at a French restaurant? It seems like everything's still in English over there now or something.
Well, yeah, there's more English version menu, but no, it's okay. It's all right.
Because I don't read French, so I don't know what I'm ordering here. Give me one of these, and how do I explain it to them here?
Yeah, my wife doesn't read French either, but she traveled with me. So.
She's covered. She's covered. All right, so you're going to France. Where else do you go? Where else do foodies go these days? France is Italy. Do you go to Italy? Do you go to?
Yeah, Italy's great. It's not so much that I plan vacations around food, but I love history. I love architecture. Even sometimes some places like cemeteries are interesting.
Yeah,
Pierre Lachaise, and it's good to mix it up. I would never go someplace just to eat and eat, but you got to do it three times a day, so might as well be good.
Right? Might as well be good. Can't just be the hotel.
Yeah, that's done. Yeah, and then you can fill up the blank in between meals.
And a lot of times, like a leisurely French lunch is a great way of decompressing in the middle of the day if you're running.
That's what they say. I've never been to France, so sitting around in little cafes or something outside in the street.
Have a nice Niçoise salad and a glass of rosé.
Niçoise salad. I don't remember the last time I had a Niçoise salad. I don't remember what's in a Niçoise salad.
Yeah. Tuna.
Tuna. Okay, yeah. There you go.
Well, and green beans and potatoes and olives.
Peppers. Anchovies, if you like. Yeah. Very special.
I make that a lot, actually.
See?
It's very healthy. It's very tasty. But it's one of my favorite food in the summer.
Comes together super fast.
Okay. So it sounds like you got a passion for French food. You're going to France. You bought the French Laundry cookbook.
I have to say one more thing, too. We need to know, because cooking is an art.
But also, clearly.
Chet is a musician.
That's what you wanted to get into. So you actually play music on the side here? You got a band somewhere that plays?
Yeah. I toured professionally for 10 years.
Oh, okay.
And we wrote 4 albums. Never had an official record label. We just kind of sell them at our gigs.
What was the name of the band and what kind of music?
The name of the band is The Nail Drivers, which sounds a lot scarier than sound is, really.
9-inch nails, yeah.
Yeah, it's a blend of our 80s influences. There's a little New Order, a little Police, a little U2, and R.E.M.
I loved R.E.M. I love all those bands. But yeah.
Put that in a blender, and that's sort of
what
came out the other end.
What? A little rock and roll.
Yeah, it's just 80s, what they would call alternative rock sound.
Yeah. I don't
know if that's a great descriptor, but yeah, we get together once a year because we're scattered across the country, and we're playing down at Sherman Gardens on July 11th, Saturday.
Look at that. Okay.
Yeah, around 6 o'clock.
I heard you play at Sherman Gardens before.
Okay.
I think it was for your birthday celebration.
Okay.
No?
Maybe, yeah.
Because I would like to impress and try to do something special.
Oh, that's right. It was my birthday.
Don't tell anyone.
Don't tell anybody.
A speakeasy.
What? Yeah. A little pop-up speakeasy? I don't think that's allowed.
You had to find it.
It's a real speakeasy.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you play? So Sting was obviously a bass player. You're a bass player?
Yeah, love Sting. Yeah, I'm a bass player. I appreciate like James Brown's bassist, Bootsy Collins. He's had a bunch.
Yeah.
Bootsy definitely had some funk. I love Peter Hook, who's the bass player for New Order, because his lines were so original and new. Mm-hmm. And that was a band where the bass played a pretty major role in the sound. If you take him out of the band, it's still good, but it's a big piece of the DNA.
Because the bass player and the drummer, they're usually just to create a beat and a tempo and move it along. They're not really highlighted or featured or whatever.
Yeah, and there's different bands. You take a band like Rush, and Neil Peart was an insane drummer, even Stuart Copeland in The Police. But it's hard to have a front man on a drum kit because the drum kit's in the back anyway. You get
Karen like, Carpenter. That's why they got her off the drums and put her up in the front. She always thought of herself as a drummer.
Yeah. Oh, Phil Collins.
I'm not saying she was a great drummer, but she was a unique. She thought of herself as a drummer.
You can see Phil Collins in the back.
Phil Collins, sure. Another, exactly.
Yeah, and Don Henley pulls it off, caught him at the Sphere. And my God, the guy still got it. It's unbelievable.
So let's go back to the food.
Okay.
So really, the connection with the
music
the,
and food?
The back door.
Oh, behind the door. Connection.
And once a week at Café Jardin, I used to make a special pack dinner to go.
Okay.
And but all the, as a thing, I was thinking, my customer's favorite, cassoulet, coq au vin, beef bourguignon, and that was always on the top of it. You pre-order the meals, those... there was a combination of protein and starch and vegetables.
Square meal.
Yeah, square meal. Almost like a TV dinner.
Yeah.
But
way up there.
I've had elevated.
I've had TV dinners. I grew up on TV dinners.
Yeah, but this is not a normal TV dinner. And so, because I wasn't open for dinner, it was a good way to. And
you had to be creative.
Also, love people were missing out on my original fine dining restaurant on Bristol. So there was a way to stay connected with fine dining and to take home dinner. I have dinner from Chef Pascal.
I don't know. We've said this before, and I'm not trying to be difficult, but I don't know of many places, Knife and Pleat, I guess, is one, but there aren't many places where you can get classic French cuisine. Marché, yeah. I don't know where I would get coq au vin or beef bourguignon or all these dishes you just dropped here.
Lix is a little place on Balboa Island. And, but no, not too many, that's for sure.
There, one time, that was the thing. If you were going out to eat, you go to a classic French, in either Italian or French restaurant.
Yeah.
That was the thing. And maybe because fusion came along, now everybody's got this undefinable mixture of everything here.
There's
California
not actually,
cuisine.
There's not too many run on top French chef in Orange County, I would say.
No, we're going to have, owner for...
Pascal was the first one.
He was the first one. He pioneered that. And that had to be not easy because you're talking to people who were used to eating kind of suburban fast food.
Yeah, actually it was easier than I thought now because I brought in a way to eat French food that was not really... define French food was my food was not rich. I brought in more food from Mediterranean, from lighter approach. It was still classic, and it's cooking with olive oil and herbs.
Because I think that's what hurt French food. It got associated with heavy sauces and butters and rich,
but
real
you
rich.
Know what the French will tell you?
Yeah, I don't.
Your sauce is rich, but it's richer if you put too much sauce on your plate.
Mm.
So. It's all about the quantity.
Don't cover it.
Don't cover it. Don't make your beef or your fish swimming in the sauce.
Yes. So many times I've had that, and I go, yuck, why am I eating this? I don't even know what I'm eating under this sauce here.
Yeah, so right seasoning, a little bit of melted butter if you want to, or just drizzle of olive oil. And we learned that a lot from the Mediterranean cuisine, Italian and Spanish, with more lighter approach, but still high flavor. And
one of the qualities of a fat is that it takes the flavor and it coats your tongue. Hmm. So it's not, you put something in your mouth, you swallow it, and it's gone. It lingers. It's got a long finish to it, so you don't need a ton of it.
And I like that. And so many times I've taken people out to dinner and they go, oh, I don't like this. I'm not used to this. I'm used to just tasting it. It's gone. I'm not used to the lingering flavor of wine or food or something here.
Here, before the show, we talk about memorizing tests, memorizing... You know,
smells.
Remembering and the smell, yeah. Because your nose is really connect the mouth and your brain. And it's very important that you memorize all these good smells. Very important.
Yeah, the 60% of what you perceive as flavor is actually smell.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can try this experiment.
Like with wine, they always want you to smell it first.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So when I was at the Cordon Bleu School in Paris, They had
he just drops that like, you know. Oh yeah, when I was last week at the when I was at the Le Cordon Bleu.
It was not Georges-Julia Charlie. Yeah. He did himself.
I love it when people just drop. Oh, it was when I was at the White House last week. Yeah, all right.
Well, they used to do wine tasting on Tuesday nights, and the head sommelier would come in, and they'd bring the cases of the essence of different scents.
Okay, so didn't know that.
If you didn't know what licorice smelled, you could take a little bottle and go, there you go. Okay. But before we got started, he brought in a fresh baguette and he said, all right, now everyone pinch your nose. And he said, do not release your nose until I say okay. He went out, went around and passed out little bits of the baguette. He said, all right, now start chewing. And so we're chewing on the baguette and it's, you know, tasty. And then he says, now release your nose. And bam.
Wow.
The flavor exploded.
I'll have to try that. I never thought of that.
Try it out.
Yeah.
That's why when you're sick and you've got a stuffy nose, everything tastes bland.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Yeah. I never thought of that. Because, again, most of us, Chef Pascal says, oh, you always envy your mother's food. We've talked about this endlessly. No, I grew up in the Midwest. All our mother's foods were lousy. It was burned. It was fast. It was crappy. And, no, we just wanted to eat it and get it over with here, for the most part. So I didn't grow up with a memory, a sensory memory of what, oh, that one. Few things here and there, but mostly it was just food was just something you did.
Paul, next time I cook for you, you don't have to pinch your nose.
Pinch my nose. Oh, chef, what is this?
It doesn't look good.
I'm pinching my nose. Ew, this is yucky. That's what I did all the time when I was a kid. I was always pinching my nose.
You know, it's very important that you have memories not only in the kitchen. When you, I remember driving, walking from the school back home, and it depends the time of the day. You could tell the time of the day when people cook at home. You have the street smell from the from the people's kitchen.
Maybe in Paris, not in suburban Detroit.
It's amazing. even a little village and city in France, even when you walk in the city during lunchtime from 12 to 1, you can see, oh, you don't need to look at your watch or your phone.
Yeah.
You know it is lunchtime. You know? And so you memorize that. That's very important.
I don't know. I didn't have that in suburbia here, in suburban Minneapolis or suburban Detroit or all these places I grew up.
Are you sure they don't have like a little slow smoking reefs and things like that?
Boy, I'd struggle to come up with anything here. Food was just something yes, everybody had family meals and stuff. But I grew up in the age of the 60s and the 50s. It was the beginning of fast food and TV dinners.
Processed food.
And McDonald's and all that kind of stuff here.
But your brain can store a lot of memories through food, of wine. You can try to memorize.
I think I told the story before. I'll tell it again quickly. So I don't have lots of great food memories going. It wasn't until I moved to California. I was like, wow, there's food that tastes good. There's really unusual stuff I never heard of. I never tasted all this stuff before. But a couple of years ago, I was out in Palm Desert and for some reason, and there was a place that called itself the Detroit, Bobby's Detroit Diner. It's not there any longer. And they flew in stuff from Detroit. And I mostly grew up in Detroit. And so there's certain kinds of pop. We did call it soda. There's certain kinds of pop. We only could get Detroit Verner's or Faygo Red Pop. So that was fun to taste some of those things again. And there was a type of hot dog. We called them Coneys. I don't know why. Coney Island dogs. There was no Coney Island in Detroit, but they called them Coneys. And you could get at the stadium, just like there's really good Farmer John hot dogs at the Dodger Dogs and stuff like that that have a certain flavor to them. And so there was some flavor that they had in this thing, and I'd forgotten it. And so I saw I have one of those hot dogs, Detroit hot dogs, Coney's, and I started crying when I had it. I hadn't thought of that. I suddenly remember my dad and I going to a ball game or something. All this stuff came flooding back. My late father.
With your
life. My God. They came over and they said, are you all right? I said, I don't know, but I'm crying. I'm having a stupid hot dog from Detroit and I'm crying.
And I said that before. Either your parents or your own family cooking at home wasn't that great. Or it could be was just fine. I say, oh, my mother wasn't a great cook, but you still memorize some of the food.
You still memorize some of it.
When you come to the kitchen, and your mother maybe has a pie in the oven.
Yeah, pies was big in our family.
Or stew, or meatloaf. Good or not, or great.
I remember that stupid hot dog more than I thought.
And you always connect that smell when you find it back to that time.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's the same thing. There are certain songs that bring you right back to your high school days.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, exactly.
But in the lobby downstairs while I was waiting for Pascal, I came across, see, we're broadcasting from UCI Research Park. And on display down there are a couple different whiz bang ideas.
Yes.
One of which is this guy created a machine that while you sleep will slowly emit different scents. Like good scents.
Really? Okay.
That's amazing. I didn't know. I never looked at that.
I never looked at those. I have a whole lobby full of those inventions that came from here. Yeah.
So the interesting thing was the theory was.
See, only he would go look at that. I've been in this building for 5 years. I never went and looked at any of those. They're in little cases, glasses.
We're a technology research center.
The interesting theory.
They'd be thrilled to know somebody finally would have looked at all these things.
Was that scent is deeply tied with your memory. So much so that people in an age 60 to 80 demographic, after sleeping with this thing for a week, noticed like a 223% increase in their recall.
Wow. Wow. Because it provokes some part of your memory that
you're sleeping and it's access. Just it's work in your brain because your brain's processing those smells. It's like, where am I?
I do know we've had a couple of people come in through these that work at Alzheimer's facilities or people that have lost memories or ate or really old. And one of the ways to reach them is through smells or through music. A lot of times somebody seems like they're in a coma or whatever, and they play a song, and they will suddenly start singing it, and they haven't spoken in a while.
I would always bring my guitar over to the family Christmas get-together, and I'd start playing. And the people that sat down and listened to me were the youngest and the oldest, the bookends. Everyone else was in the kitchen outside drinking beer, having a good time. But the kids and the seniors loved it.
Yeah. Because seniors, that's is one of the memories that they always say as you're dying too. You're, they can still hear even if they're in a coma.
Yeah, that box regenerates your memory.
Yeah,
it provokes. You're trying to poke the little parts of your memories that you haven't used, the little synapses.
Yeah, you wake up the neurons.
It reactivates part of your brain that. It's still there, but you haven't accessed in a long time here. Thought about a computer. Yeah, it's a little hidden drive.
That's why I'm glad I brought you in. Now I'm going to look.
We're going to have to go down and look at this stuff. I didn't know it. I'll look like a bunch of gadgets and gizmos in these cases.
If it's not there when I come back.
All right. Thank you for joining us here and walking us through these memories.
One little thing.
Yes.
That's quite important.
Important to you? Time's up. Sorry. No. Go ahead.
Chet, my friend Chet. He's helping me putting together my cookbook.
Oh. Yeah.
He's so savvy with all the technology and that.
To lay it out.
I am able to give the story, and he can transcribe them and things like that. And I can't wait.
He's got a lot of great stories.
How many years you've been writing this cookbook?
I would say... My cookbook starts when I first cooking.
When I first met him, he was writing a cookbook.
This is why I'm his personal trainer, is what I am.
Exactly. Yeah, I know.
Exactly. We got to get this thing done. You keep saying this cookbook's out there.
We're making a lot for
And I would bet there are a lot. Oh, yeah. So what is the theme? Is there a theme to the cookbook, or is it just a series of recipes? Is there a story to the cookbook?
More mini stories that are attached to my culinary journey.
Okay.
A different chapter of my culinary life,
right?
From Normandy, where I was born, to Belgium, where I went to study in a hotel management college, and then to Lyon, where I work in fine dining, and then in South of France, in Provence,
Saint-Tropez, where you serve Brigitte Bardot.
Then brought that all of that to California.
Right.
So each location is a chapter.
So, that'd be cool. I hope to see this book sometime in my lifetime here. So you've been talking about it. Let's get this thing going here.
It's going.
Okay.
We
need a technologist. We need a trainer.
We meet every week and we make progress.
Oh, good. Okay.
Every week.
Keep each other on.
And will it be a little book, a coffee table book, a online book? I don't know what books are today.
Now you can start with not to have to do hardcover right away because it's expensive for publishing. But you can do a soft cover, you can do online, Barnes & Noble or place like that. People
Maybe it's a graphic novel. It's an adult comic book. No?
I'm looking forward to accepting the James Beard Award.
Yes, right.
Yeah, why not? No,
could be. LA Times.
It could be a bestseller.
LA Times has their book festival this weekend. We're doing this in the 15th.
Late. Yeah, no, we'll make
but this. They have a publishers there. That's a fun event to go to.
I'll bet.
And they have just tents all over the place. I think it's free. Or it doesn't cost them. I think it's free to go there. And they have tents of all these independent publishers all over the place. We went there 1 year and covered it. I was amazed at all these specialty publishers working. I'm sure there's lots of people working on cookbooks, because cookbooks have never been more popular.
Totally, always. But we want to make it so people enjoy opening the book instead of just keep it on the shelf.
Yeah, because that's where most cookbooks reside. And then you pull it out, you go to that page, and you look at the... Yeah.
I don't mind if a cookbook gets stain on it. That's a good
sign. It's a good sign. It's a living cookbook. Yeah. It's not a museum cookbook here. Yeah. All right. I look forward to now one more reason to tune. Do we have a title for the cookbook yet? No.
We haven't.
Working title. Working title? Okay.
But it's more Chef Pascal Travel Log. Something like
a travelogue. Okay, there you go. So it has a travelogue, a traveling feel to it here. Okay, that's more than I've learned about the cookbook in the last couple of years here. All I hear is, I'm working on my cookbook.
Yeah.
All right, I'm working on the story of my life. How's that going here? All right, thanks for joining us here today. And we'll look forward to any projected timelines. Can we put it out there? Part of achieving a goal is to start stating it publicly. I'm going to publish it next year. I'm going to go to the moon. And
maybe by the end of the year, we'll have something.
Yeah, I think that's totally reasonable. You start off, we've done a massive sprint. He's got all the content.
Oh, except for content, I'm sure.
Some of the fun stories, but those are easy to capture. We just got to... The last 10% is going to take the most work to edit and incoming.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll have to use AI. AI is for everything now. We'll have to dig through
it.
AI to sift through it and make sense of it.
In my broken English.
Well, it's better than my broken French, so any day. All right, thank you so much for joining us here today. What an interesting journey here. Technology meets cooking meets music. It can be left brain and right brain here at the same time.
The main thing is good life.
A good life, that's it. A good life is a well-lived life is a little bit of both here. You got to have a little left brain, a little right brain here. All right, thanks for joining us.
All right, merci.
There you have it. One more reason to tune in. You never know what you're going to hear find behind the kitchen doors with Chef Pascal right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio, streaming live from our studios here at the University of California, Irvine's Beal Applied Innovation Center. With apparently lots of great machines downstairs to check out.